Welcome to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, the place where teachers from around the world meet to share innovative ideas about music education. Listen and learn as we help you motivate your students, grow your income, expand your studio, and become a more creative piano teacher.
Welcome back to another edition of the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, and thanks so much for listening. My name is Tim Topham, and I'm the teacher behind the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, the blog at timtopham.com, and the Inner Circle Piano Teaching Community. And this is the podcast to listen to if you're a piano teacher and you're interested in teaching in a more contemporary and creative way. Each week, we explore fresh ideas for your teaching or business, interview the most interesting and innovative music educators from around the world, and give you a regular dose of creative inspiration for your studio. As usual, the show notes and full transcript are available at timtopham.com/episode77. So in today's session, I'm really, really excited about this one. We're right in the middle of Creativity Month on the blog and the podcast, and today we're talking all about lead sheets, what they are, why and how we should be teaching them, and the kind of benefits that students can get from learning about them. Using lead sheets and playing around with chords is one of the most fundamental ways and simple ways of adding some creativity to your piano lesson. So it's something I really want to encourage you to do. And I know that my guest today is going to help you in that process, particularly if you're classically trained and this is way out of your comfort zone. My guest is a professional musician, a lecturer and teacher, and an author too. She has been teaching piano for over 20 years, and her students learn both classical and contemporary styles, including playing by ear and improvisation. She also gives professional development workshops to private teachers, performs professionally as a pianist and organist, and lectures in music theory and music appreciation. Susan Dees, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tim. Hello.
Now, I actually found out about you from one of my workshop attendees when I was doing some workshops in Sydney last year. And they said, oh, as soon as I started talking about lead sheets, someone said, you've got to find out about Susan Dees. And I actually totally forgot about it until I re-watched the video we took of the workshops. And I went, oh, okay, I've got to investigate. And I have been blown away by the stuff that you have put together to help piano teachers in this area. And not just that, but you also did a whole heap of research. So proper university level masters, I think. You haven't got a doctorate yet. Yeah, master's level. Master's level research on lead sheets. Can you believe it? So I can't wait to talk about this today. It's going to be great. Firstly, though, you mentioned a few times in your research about the wording we use to describe these lead sheets and chord charts and things, and that can actually be part of the issue of why perhaps we don't all include it, because we don't actually know what we're talking about sometimes. So can you clear it up for us? What are we talking about today?
Well, what I was talking about is when you have a piece of music that's got just the melody and the lyrics and the chords, and then you have to turn that into a full arrangement on the piano with, and I was specifically with the melody in it, not just sort of comping on the chords, but playing the melody as well. That's what I was going for.
Yeah. And so my understanding is a lead sheet generally has the melody with the chords above, whereas a chord chart would just have chord symbols and lyrics sometimes if it's a pop song. Is that your understanding?
It's increasingly meaning that. I think there's some problems with the terms. It'd be nice if everybody was really consistent about calling it that, but I don't think they do. I know when I did my research, there wasn't any consistent word for it, and even less any kind of consistent word for doing it.
Yeah,
faking is the nearest people come, and of course there's nothing fake about it.
No.
It's tricky. It is increasingly being called a lead sheet and then playing from a lead sheet. I think that will help.
So let's stick with the term lead sheet, and we're talking about when you just have a single line of music, which is a melody with chord symbols above and no left hand or any other music written down on the sheet. And the thing is, we're going to try and help our students be able to play that. And I think you've called it realize a lead sheet.
Yeah, that's what they called it in a Baroque continuo music, realizing a figured bass. It's the problem with a form that's half jazz and half Baroque.
That's probably where it came from, though, is it?
It's the same sort of idea. That Baroque continuo thing is where they, a different system, but where they're reading, they're making up an accompaniment based on a shorthand of some sort.
And it's almost, when you use the word faking it, I understand what you're talking about, but it's almost more real than playing notated music, right?
Oh, yes. There's so nothing fake about it.
So before we go into your research, tell us a little bit about the teaching you do today. What kind of numbers and ages and things like that?
Okay, I've got about 30 students, and about half of those are adults and half of them are kids. And the kids are more in primary school. At the moment, I've got more in primary school than high school. Mm-hmm. And I just teach from my own studio. Yeah. Okay.
Fantastic. And obviously, as per the introduction, including a fair bit of mixed repertoire plus improvisation and creative things.
Yeah, I think so. I suppose everybody says they try and give a broad musical education. Not a very big focus on exams is what I tell the parents as soon as I possibly can. I do them, but not all the time and with all students. Mm. So, yeah.
Do you find some parents are against that or push back or go somewhere else when you say that, or actually are they okay with it?
When it's at the beginning, sometimes they go somewhere else. Sometimes I say to them, I don't have a strong exam focus. That's something you should know. And then they go to somebody else, and I'm perfectly okay with that.
Yeah, me too. And I'm very clear up front. I say the same thing. Yeah. And I also say, if there is a possibility that we do an exam with your child, then there is no way I would ever do it in the first year of taking them on.
I say that too. Not in the first, more than a year, actually. I would say the first few years is probably what I would say.
Yeah. All right. So your master's thesis was titled Improvising from Lead Sheets, Attitudes of Australian Piano Teachers. And this research, I think you said, was done in 2007, actually.
Yes.
So we're 10 years on, and we'll talk about what might have changed in the meantime. But why on earth did you decide to commit to doing research on this?
Because I've always been passionate about it. I've heard you talk about having the same experience, people coming up to you and saying, I used to play piano, I don't play anymore. I used to play regularly in restaurants and clubs and stuff, and I felt like every single weekend I would hear that. And so I started talking to people at my church. I was doing music at church, and there were people who could play on the music roster and people who couldn't. And I just started asking everybody I knew who'd play piano, who of the ones that still played, what was different. And it's so anecdotal research, but yeah, it seemed to me that the ones who kept playing were the ones who could play from lead charts.
Mm.
And then they kept playing up because that was a way in, I think. Yeah.
It's interesting. You have an experience on organ and in liturgical or church music. I had the same experience growing up, and I know a number of other people. I wonder if you've had the same experience. Any pianists or teachers that you know who have played hymns or played organ or accompanied church services tend to be much more focused on a chordal approach and slightly more creative approach to teaching, and certainly lead sheets. I've found that. Have you found that as well?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Organists just need to fill in regularly, you know, before the bride arrives, after the bridesmaid faints, during communion. Although I actually didn't grow up playing organ, so it didn't start there with me. But yeah, certainly I think there's more of a sense of improvisation being important with organ than piano.
Mm. There's definitely a strong correlation there. And I'm always thankful for my ability to play hymns. And I think reading four-part lines and sight reading hymns has given me such great skills in sight reading generally. So I actually like getting my students to do it.
And a deadline every week probably doesn't make
it. That's true.
Doesn't hurt
That's
either.
True. Yeah, performing
Please,
every week.
Now.
Exactly. Yeah. So what questions were you looking to answer in this research that you did?
Well, so my main thing was to find out my main thing was to fix it, really, to see if we can find out how to get more people teaching it. So I wanted to find out who can do it. This is play from a lead sheet. Who can do it? Who teaches it? Who thinks it would be important to teach it, what they think about it, and then why they don't teach it, if they don't, and what would help them to teach it. So, yeah.
And the majority, I assume, didn't teach lead sheets?
70% of them said they teach it sometimes. That's a bit broad, so I'm not quite sure what that means. Only 9% said they teach it, you know, to all or nearly all their students.
Mm. Yeah. And I've made a point in a number of podcasts recently about talking about what we're trying to achieve in our piano lessons, what we would like little Johnny to be able to do when they finish and after they finish lessons with us. And I think this was a key aspect of your research, because a number of the questions you asked was about what is important for students to know to keep on playing after they finish with you.
Yeah, yeah, and, very important.
Yeah, and a lot of them said, I'm going to see if I can find your stat, because I wrote it down because I thought this is really, really good. A lot of them said, like over 70% said, one of those things that's going to keep them playing is this ability to improvise, create, and play with lead sheets, right?
Yes, they did agree with that, yep.
Yeah. So give us a quick overview. What were the main findings then?
Well, the best news was that they were very positive towards the skill. I thought I was going to get, you know, lots of people saying it was, you know, I actually had somebody say to me before I did the research, I don't want my students to cheat. And I thought I was going to get more of that. In fact, I got huge amounts of positivity. They thought it's a really important skill. I was astonished. Actually, I think 85% made positive comments about it as a skill. So that's good. But when it comes to teaching it and why they don't teach it, it was things like, the biggest one was time in the lesson, and then sometimes lack of confidence, things like that. So it was interesting. They want to do it, but they're not.
Yes. And therefore, you have come to some findings about how you can bridge that gap, I guess.
Yeah,
we'll talk about some of those ideas a bit later. Why do you feel so passionate about lead sheets as being an important aspect for teaching piano students?
I think it's just sort of the core of all the sort of improvisation things. Improvisation means so many different things, and it's not a very helpful term unless you start talking specifically, I think. But that particular one, being able to play from chords and turn it into arrangement, is just, if you can do that, you can do so much. You can take you can play from a lead sheet, but also you can take a piece of music that's got chords and make it better, like simpler if it's stupidly hard, or more interesting if it's too easy, or you can play by ear and turn it into a full arrangement. You can compose and turn it into a full arrangement. You can adapt it to different styles. Like, once you can do that, you can do a whole bunch of other things that I think are really useful.
Mm. It's a kind of a doorway, isn't it?
Yeah.
A skill that opens up a whole lot of other potential.
Yeah, I think so.
I love that there seemed to me to be a complete contradiction in the results that the piano teachers were talking about, because and I wrote this down as from your research, 75% of your group, how many people in the group, by the way?
119, I think, were 119 respondents.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, which is good.
Yeah. And all over the world or just local Sydney?
They were Sydney and regional New South Wales. So it was a school holiday piano teachers festival at the conservatorium in Sydney. So it was people who lived in Sydney or people who could travel there for the couple of days during their school holidays.
Mm. Fascinating to redo this with a worldwide audience. Today.
Wouldn't that be interesting? Yeah.
We might have to talk about that. Anyway, the research that I liked was 75% of agreed that pianists should be able to play from a lead sheet. 90% agreed that playing from a lead sheet is a useful skill in many musical fields. And 77% agreed that the ability to play from a lead sheet might help keep my students playing after lessons stop. So that's over three quarters said that.
It's huge, isn't it?
It's absolutely really huge. And cultivating a love of music and giving students the best chance to keep playing after they stop lessons and giving students a broad musical education. This was rated the highest thing that teachers wanted to do in their lessons.
Yes.
But then you looked at what they're actually doing, and the lowest rated activity that they thought was important was preparing students for the possibility of a concert stage, right?
Yes.
That was the thing they rated.
The least important thing.
Least important.
Yeah.
And yet what's the most frequently included item in all the lessons of the teachers? It's technique
and repertoire.
Traditional repertoire, sight reading and theory.
Yep.
So how do you account for this being so contradictory?
It's bad, isn't it? I don't know. Maybe there's lots of reasons. I think you were talking about in one of your recent podcasts. I don't think we think about it often enough. I don't think we spend time sitting down thinking, what do I want my students to get out of, you know, it can be 10 years of lessons, thousands of dollars. But then there's, you know, this people are sort of on a treadmill sometimes, I think. You do one exam, then you do the next exam, and then you do the one after that. And people think that parents want it, and sometimes parents do. Yeah, those sorts of things. I think parent pressure.
Parent pressure is a big one. And I wonder, we were talking just a moment ago about the way we interact with our parents at the start and the kind of things we say. Have you got any tips of for teachers who perhaps have quite an exam heavy load of students but realize that that might not be the best way to teach? Is there a way that they can broach that with parents who seem to be quite full on about it?
Yeah, I think leaving out the ones that before they come into lessons, so the ones you've already got who are already doing exams, I think it's really important to sit down and talk to parents about it. And I think it helps to remember that we're the ones who know how to teach piano and the parents don't, and to come from that sort of confidence, to be able to think, I know what's best here, and to get more convincing about it, we have to be a bit brave, to stand up to them. But lots of parents, really, quite a lot of parents want what's best for their child. and if you can convince them that another way of learning is just as well or just as good or better for their child, then maybe you can get somewhere.
Mm, I think it's about that conversation and the importance of having it. Of course, teachers in the US may be wondering what on earth we're talking about with all these exams because it's not such a focus over there. However, my understanding is that the preparing for festivals and performance is quite a big thing over there. So I think there's still a bit of a barrier to the more creative aspects. But over here, of course, yes, and in Europe too, the push for exams is big and strong and can be strong from parents. So it's about educating them. Most of them just don't realize. And I'm sure if we asked the parents, would you like your child to continue playing the piano for the rest of their life? Then what are they going to say?
No, I don't think so.
I'm just going to spend thousands and stuff. Of course they're going to say yes.
Yeah.
And then the next question would be, well, can I show, let's discuss the best ways to get them to do that, because it's not in pushing them to the next highest exam.
One of the sentences I use a lot is exams don't measure every aspect of playing the piano. They do have they tend to have a strong focus on technique and repertoire, and there's lots of other things about playing piano that are important.
Mm. And we should mention too that there are a variety of exam boards, and some of them do have bigger focus on improvising. I wonder if I know ANZCA, ANZCA, has improvising. I don't know if they have lead sheet playing as such. Do you know?
Yeah, they do towards the very higher grades. I think 6, 7, and 8 is when it starts to get more necessary. But they do have sort of general improvisation things before that, I think.
Mm.
Oh, that's on their, I think, I'm not an expert, but on their modern piano syllabus.
Yes, yeah. And, I don't want this to be an exam bashing session by any means, because there is plenty of good that comes from exams.
Yeah.
It's just the way I think we use them in our
lessons. I don't think we can blame the exam boards. It's us who decides what we do. It's how as you say, it's how we use them.
Mm.
That's the problem. Yeah.
So what kind of student ability level can we start looking at this lead sheet style playing at?
Well, this particular aspect, I think, is certainly for older students, not first day.
Oh, there we go. I can hear the plane coming over the top.
Yes, that'll be a plane.
Sorry, say that again.
Certainly it's something that's for older students. What I do is get them started on chords as soon as they can play chords, as soon as their little fingers are able to play some chords. I just quietly in the background get them learning all the major chords and then all the minor chords. And that's something we just work away at, so that when their hands get a bit bigger and they get a bit more coordination, then we can start to work towards that playing from a lead sheet.
And when it is
for old students, of course. Yeah.
When you're first introducing chords, what are they playing, right hand or left hand or together? What are they doing?
Hands separately. I'm afraid I discovered from the sad experience of doing this early on that you can know chords in your right hand and not know them in your left hand. Mm-hmm. So hands separately. There's not a lot of point in doing it hands together, because one hand just follows the other hand. So they just run through their right hand, then run through their left hand.
Yeah. And do you give them a particular chord progressions to practice them on, or do you go around the cycle of fifths, or what do you do?
I just made a random sheet, a sheet that's got all the chords written on it in a box, so that they can go down the columns or across or backwards.
And it's just a random mix.
Yeah, around the cycle of fifths is good for lots of things, but doesn't work well for chords, because there's the patterns too obvious. It's all the white ones, then all the, and so on.
Yes.
They don't tend to learn them individually.
Yep. So it's important to mix it up so they can grab one whenever they need it. Yep.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay. So I got a couple of other little questions here, because I think one of the comments you got back a fair bit, I'm just having a look through my notes, sorry. It says 72% said, I would teach playing from lead sheets if it was required for exams, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
But 29%, so almost 30% said, I'm too busy preparing my students for exams to teach them anything else. I think one of the issues we all have in our piano lessons, which is why I'm so focused on helping teachers work out where they're trying to get, is that we never have enough time in a lesson to do everything, right?
Oh, that's so true. It's like the most precious resource in the world, you know? More precious than gold.
So we might have lots of teachers nodding their head going, oh, this is so true. I have to do this. Yeah. But how do I find the time?
Yeah. Well, if you possibly can, longer lessons. Seriously, if you can get 45 minutes or an hour, I know that's not always possible, but because I'm in my own studio, I can make my own rules, and I don't teach very many 30-minute lessons at all. Which means, by the way, you have fewer students and the same amount of money, less admin, more. longer lessons if you possibly can. And I do a thing where I have an idea of, in their lesson, how long I want to spend on each thing, technique and repertoire and all the different aspects. I don't stick to it as accurately as I can, but at least I've got a plan. So that helps a little bit. And then you can do stuff with,
do you tend to have, you've been teaching for a number of years, so perhaps it's not written out, but would it be useful, do you think, for teachers, maybe if they're beginning or just trying to fit something in, to actually just plan out, just note down some things they need to cover?
Yeah, I think so. I think it doesn't have to be student specific. It might be age specific. And I think it's a really valuable exercise to say, I've got, 1 hour, 45 minutes, whatever you've got, I want to spend 5 minutes on this, 10 minutes on that. And if you don't do that, you're flying blind. You have to, because the first time you do it, you're going to say, right, so that adds up to an hour and a half. What am I really going to do?
Yes.
And I think you need to have that. I have a sort of a halfway through their lesson is when I need to get to playing pieces, various sort of things like that, that are a bit of a guide.
I had one of my young students yesterday, and we've been working on his understanding of the three different types of minor scale.
Yeah,
we've been working on this for a number of weeks now, and I think he has 45-minute lessons. I avoid 30s as well. I think we probably spent 20 minutes revising this and going through it again and practicing. And after that, I think it's very easy for us to kind of, hit ourselves on the back and go, no, that's bad. I haven't covered everything that I wanted to cover. But you know what? That's what I needed to go over.
Yeah, I think that's important. You have the plan, and then sometimes you don't follow the plan.
Yes.
Because sometimes I feel guilty. I'll have a lesson where I'll have a long talk about Beethoven and his music and what his life was like, and I'll show them some pictures, and then I think, I didn't do sight reading, and I didn't do ear training, and I didn't do – but that's the lessons that people remember. So it's a balance, I think.
Yeah.
It's hard.
I still remember in year 10, this is completely off topic, we had an English teacher, brilliant guy, and I was in one of those years at school where they were just introducing laptops to the whole school, and he was the deputy head, so he had a big role in this, and we used to love getting him off topic to talk about laptops. He would talk about it for an entire period. And we were trying to get him off every lesson, and he would do it. And eventually he said, now, boys, you know that this is quite useful discussion we're having here. And, he was an English teacher, so he was actually exploring this idea about discussion and debate and things. So it was really funny. Yep. So you know what? They're the lessons I remember from him. I don't remember anything else.
Yeah. So it's a trade-off, isn't it? So sometimes you have to throw the plan out the window, but you have to have at least thought of it.
You do, yeah. All right. So I want to go into some tricks and some ideas that you have for helping teachers if they would like to start doing this with their students. Before that, the research is now about 10 years old.
Yeah.
What do you think, if anything, has changed? Have you got a sense around the piano teaching community that this is changing?
I think various aspects of improvisation are becoming more and more important. I think it's becoming a buzzword, really, improvisation. So I think there's the idea is much clearer that is this something we should be doing? I'm not sure that we're changing to match that. I think it's kind of good news and bad news. I think we're talking about it more, but I think we're still struggling to do it. So perhaps we're just feeling worse.
Oh, Susan.
I hope that's not true. But, you know, like I think that can be a thing. You're always being told more things that you should be doing, that whole crowded curriculum thing.
Well, look,
at least it's a start.
Yeah. I mean, my experience in the last 6, 7, 8 years of blogging has been a huge amount of positivity regarding the writing that I've done about improvising and a lot of people trying it out. So I think there's more openness to not just talk about it, but in my experience to try it, even if it hasn't yet become a regular part of everyone's lesson, people are exploring it. They're giving it a shot and just seeing what it's like.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's more resources becoming available slowly.
Totally.
And more people are trying things.
Yes.
I'm not sure we've got it sorted yet, but I keep seeing things that's another person having another go at giving us some resources. So we're getting somewhere.
Now, tell us a little bit about the resource that you've created for this. This isn't meant to be a sales call or anything that, but I do want to talk about it because it is a fantastic resource for both students and teachers in introducing this kind of concept in your studio. And you mentioned just a moment ago you had a sheet of chords, for example, and how you get students to practice them. That's in this book too. So just tell us a little bit about what you've put together.
So I wrote a book because nobody else did. I went looking in the shops to try and find something that would do the job. I really wanted to teach my students this and I really couldn't find anything. They all start, you know, they start with major and minor chords and they go straight to stride bass or something really difficult or minor seventh chords with added ninths. And there wasn't anything that was really step by step. And I'm the kind of person who will sit down for hours working out an exercise that uses every chord in every inversion. And so I wrote the book. And I tried it out on a few students and then I rewrote it and then I published it. So, yeah, it's I use it with my students and it's basically a step-by-step way of teaching them very specifically how to play from a lead sheet.
Mm.
It doesn't do soloing. It doesn't do comping. It doesn't do very much theory. I kept saying to myself, I'm only writing one book here, not all the other books.
Yes, it's very practical.
So it is one specific thing. Yeah, that's what it's meant to be. It is meant to be that you can work through it, not knowing anything about, at least not knowing anything about improvising and being, it's meant for people who are trained classically, who can read music.
Yeah.
But then work through it and be able to play eventually from lead sheets.
And I love that it's not a jazz, I've got nothing against jazz
books.
No, it's
not.
But a lot of jazz books are just, they go way over my head and I've had lessons in it. So if people are listening and going, oh, it's another one of those books, it's absolutely not. And in fact, it's less about, if we talk improvising is another word that has many meanings. I think a lot of people think improvising means, woo, jazz all over the place.
Yeah.
Yours is not about that. It's just about being able to see a lead sheet and be able to play how it should go, right?
Yeah, make it into a song. Yeah.
It's fundamental, but you're right. I haven't found anything out there and I've started putting my own ideas out. So I love that you've already done it. So give us a few tips. You've talked about what you do with beginners and I do something very similar, just introducing chords as soon as they can, really. What about from near the start of your book, let's say you've got a teenager, they can read music okay, but they have no idea about how to do these lead sheet things.
So I think the biggest thing is that you've got to get the chord across into the right hand. I think it's easy to get stuck in the sort of dead end of chord in the left hand, melody in the right hand, and then accompaniment pattern in the left hand, melody in the right hand. And that can only go so far because in the end the harmonics of the piano suit a chord in the treble and octaves are a single note in the left. It's actually, you know, fourth grade musicianship, piano voicing, you know, a closed position chord in one hand, in the right hand, and octaves or something like that in the left, and then the melody on top of that. So the bit that's hard, I say to my students a lot, the first bit is the hardest bit, is getting the inversion of the chord that gets the melody on top of the chord. So you do need to know all your chords and I'm afraid you need to know all your inversions. And so, you know, getting the, you find the first note of the piece and you put the chord that matches that so that the melody note's on top. And that's the hard bit. After that, everything's quite easy because then you just sort of repeat what you've already found a bit and fill it up a little bit. It's that getting that chord into the right hand instead of the left is the big barrier, I think.
It is a real challenge. And what do you use to get students to practice this?
Well, in my book, I've got an improv exercise. In fact, I've got 12 of them, but the first one's the biggest one, I guess, where it's got all the chords in all the major and all the minor. I'm just this kind of person. It's all the major chords and all the minor chords in all their inversions, and where they have two names, they're there under both names. And it's just a harmonic exercise where they have to read the chord and the melody note and play the chord with the melody note on top and the octave in the left. And by the time they're sort of working their way through that exercise, they're ready to do songs.
Got it. Okay. And then you introduce them to some songs that use just those chords in inversions without sevenths and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So just starting with major and minor. Mm-hmm. And I had to do all sorts of things about finding songs that didn't have, you know, the first song has to have no chord, no melody note that's not in the chord.
Yeah. That is like impressive that you found this.
It was an adventure finding. So we'll sing Matilda, it turns out. Can be done with only the chord melody note being in the chord.
There you go.
It wasn't being patriotic. It was just the song that worked.
For those overseas, Waltzing Matilda is our unofficial national anthem. Great little tune. And now I know it has only chords with the fifth in the melody. There you go. So in your inversion exercise, because I imagine any teacher could create something like this, although it would be reasonably time consuming. So in this, you've got a melody line and you've got a note. So the first one might be G, the note G, and it might be a C chord. And so that's a root position chord. And then somewhere else in there, you've got the chord C above a C. And somewhere else you've got a C above an E.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's the same for every chord.
Yeah. And I made it a progression that works harmonically, like it sounds all right.
Okay.
So that you can tell when you've made a mistake as you're playing it. Like it sounds wrong if you hit a major instead of a minor or something like that.
Brilliant. So, what a great idea. I love it. And I think you say in your book, until you can do this at a particular metronome speed, don't go on.
Yeah, you have to get a bit of fluency, I think. Although, you know, I don't want to tell people to not do anything really. Have a go, maybe. One of the things, we haven't talked about this, but one of the things that came up in my research is that most of the people who can do this taught themselves. I mean, I guess that's partly about resources, but of the people who said they had the skill, 2/3 of them learnt it themselves rather than learning from a teacher. Because it wasn't taught. But it does, I think you can look at that as an encouragement and say you can have a go at it on your own. And also, like, you know, with kids, you can, if you get them started, maybe they'll keep going on their own. That's something to cling to, I think, in trying to get them to do this. So. Yeah.
Well, just having that way of practicing that isn't a monotonous cycle of fifths or chromatic or something, I think is great, particularly if it has some sense of musicality and harmony about it.
It has to sound okay.
Yeah, that's great. And so let's say a student is able to do that and then they try it out in a few simple lead sheets, some hymns or some traditional folk songs or something like that.
Yes.
How do they then progress? What do you tend to do in the following few stages?
Well, then you need to know what to do when the melody note isn't on the chord, which is not very complicated. You just play it on top of the chord.
Play the chord and then add that.
Yeah, note. Put the melody note. Yep. Yeah. And then things like how to fill up the gaps a bit.
What do you mean by
most
that?
Most songs, Waltzing Matilda again was first because it doesn't have very many long notes. Most songs will have, you know, a few minims and longer notes, and you want to try and fill those up a little bit. I'd say to my students, you're trying to be the whole band.
Yeah.
And so a guitarist would keep strumming, and so the piano player has to keep playing something. And what they'll do is, the simplest way of doing that is use the octaves in the left hand and the fifth in the middle of the octave. So, like, if you're playing C octaves with your left hand, the G in the middle of that, which your second finger will fall onto. So those notes will give you a little bit of just starting to get some rhythm and filling up the gaps. And then as you progress, there's more things you can do to fill up the gaps, except you need to remember that it's not about filling the gaps. It's about the melody. Don't get too excited about that.
I brought out a pattern and style sheet last week for left hand because one of the things I find is that often students don't realize the important effect that the left hand gives, depending on whether it's doing a... Or is it doing a, you know, this kind of thing? Like it's two completely different styles. It doesn't matter what the chord says or the melody note could be the same. The lead sheet could look the same, but is it a tango or is it a Mozart classical piece? So I put this together, and I've mentioned in there too about repetition, and you've mentioned it in your book a few times. Yeah. Tell us about where we can go wrong when it comes to left-hand patterns.
Oh, I had a student in the early days of me when I was still writing this book. I had an adult student who had figured out, as far as she'd worked out accompaniment patterns in the left hand, but she could tell that if you do the same pattern at the same time over and over, it gets boring. She could tell that herself, of course. And so she thought what she had to do is make it more interesting, make the accompaniment more interesting. So she did more. And then that sounded boring. And then the next minute she's doing really, really complicated left-hand patterns. And it was completely overpowering the melody. And I virtually all I had to say to her was do less. It's why I talk more about filling up the gaps than having a pattern. It's just a way of showing that it's just the holes you need to fill. Most of the time we want to hear the melody. We've all heard those piano players sometimes who it's just somewhere in there is the melody, but mostly it's listen to my arpeggios.
Well, it's become a very common way of scoring arrangements now.
Yeah, yeah.
More and more so.
Yeah, it's a bit sad, really. Hmm. Because we're such pattern people. We hear patterns, we lock on to patterns. And if we start to hear a pattern, a really repetitive pattern, then that's what we're going to start to focus on, and we're not going to lose the melody. But it doesn't mean you can't use patterns. It just means break them up a bit.
Yeah.
Mix just them up. Use them the whole time. Mm. Yeah. Just exactly. Stop doing it just for a moment. Stop. For a bar.
Yeah.
<That's> then go again.
Exactly right. And in that sheet, if anyone missed it, just head to my blog and you can grab that download and use it in your lessons. I want people to use it. I actually give a number of different styles, the stock standard pattern, and then a few variations, so that you know you can explore some different things with students. And again, I do say, it's not if you continue that pattern over and over again, you're going to drive everyone crazy. So it doesn't matter what style you're going for; it doesn't have to continue the whole time.
Yeah, sometimes less is more.
Absolutely, absolutely, brilliant. And I know that we haven't really talked about sevenths, for example. And I know. I'll wait for the plane to go. Hang on.
Yeah, sure. Sorry about that.
You did warn me. Seventh chords, and this is another problem I think with a lot of jazz books, is that it's like, bang, sevenths, and all the different types of seventh chords are introduced so early, and it's so confusing.
What don't they understand about step by step?
Yeah, I know. I'm with you. I'm with you, Susan. When do you actually think that it's important to add sevenths, and what do they do if they see a seventh and they haven't learned it in inverted commas yet?
Oh, for starters, you can, at the very beginning, you can leave it out. Mm. It nearly always works. If you see G7, play a G. If you see G little M7, play a G minor. Mm-hmm. If you see G major 7, play a G major. So that's at the beginning. And then I think I try and teach it step by step. So I teach them dominant seventh chords first, so like G7, because that's the most common one. And I wait until they're good at that before I tell them about minor sevenths. And then I wait until they're good at that before I tell them about major sevenths. The step-by-step thing is, I mean, jazz musicians are so very, very clever and they understand their theory so much, and sometimes they can't stop talking about it. And so they want to explain everything all in one go, and that's not so good for the student.
No, or teachers. I know that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, context is okay, but then don't make them practice everything at once.
Hmm.
Get started on one thing.
And last question, we talked about the importance of, in your opinion, doing these exercises in order to get fluency. What if you do have a teenager who really wants to learn a particular, let's say it's a pop song, and they found a lead sheet and the chords are relatively easy? Would you help them work on that on the side perhaps?
Yes, I would. I would do both. Mm. Yep. Both is the answer to all questions, you know, like should I do classical or improvisation? Both. Should I keep going working through the exercises or do the lead sheet? Both.
Yes.
I would add, because when they're enthusiastic, that's when you've got them on side. Absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah.
The song, and as soon as I can, if they don't suggest it themselves, I'll say it's time for you to pick a pop song and have a go at it, you know, pick something you like. It can be hard to find something that's doable, but we have a go. Yeah, that's what it's about. That's what got me started. Billy Joel and Peter Allen and Elton John.
Yeah, I have a feeling one of the reasons that I am still playing and I'm so passionate about it and helping other teachers is that my teacher helped me learn whatever I wanted to learn. It didn't matter what it was. I remember learning some Glenn Miller. I learned some a fair bit of jazz when she wasn't a jazz teacher. Just anything. She'd give it a shot. And it is
it's so really important. Yeah. You go with where their enthusiasm is, and then if you're clever, you can direct it the way you want it to go, but then you do it with them on side.
Exactly. That's
really the way. Yeah. Mm.
And I know neither you nor I would advocate just going by what the student wants all the time. That's not the way. Yeah. That's not good teaching. We have to manage the both. But as you say, it's such a great motivator.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what we want. We want them to keep playing. Yeah.
Mm. Well, I think we might wrap it up there. A good conclusion. And thank you so much for your time today. It's been absolutely a pleasure speaking with you. Is there anything we've missed just before we wrap things up that you wanted to cover or that you feel is important?
No, I think that sounds great. Have a go. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Have you heard that? It's a really useful thing. Try something.
Yeah.
I didn't make it up. Yeah.
So you can find out more about Susan, and you can grab a copy of her book from susandees.com.au. That is SusanDeas for Sam.com.au. And that is right. That's where the book is.
Yes, there. It's on my website, yeah.
Fantastic.
And there's some extra resources there too, some things about chord. I'll put the chord pattern that you can practice from on there, and there's already just an explanation of chords, just a page that tells you what a minor seventh chord is and an add six and all of that.
Ah, brilliant, brilliant. In fact, maybe shoot me a link to that, and I'll actually put a link in our show notes to those direct pages. That would be really, really great. Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you so much, Susan. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
So full show notes and transcript, all the links we've mentioned today will be at timtopham.com/episode77. Also check out my recent posts on patterns and styles, including that free download that I was just talking about today that came out last week. And you can find out more about that from timtopham.com/blog. And I also had a post called What's the Difference Between a Chord Chart and a Lead Sheet? And I gave away a free copy of my Creative Chords download and a video there of how I actually teach it. So you can grab that too from my blog as well. So I hope that's been helpful to you, and I look forward to seeing you all in the next episode. Thanks a lot.
Ladies and gentlemen, that will conclude this evening's entertainment.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. We'd love to help take your teaching to the next level as a member of our supportive community. Use the coupon PIANOPODCAST for $100 off an annual membership of Tim's Inner Circle today. To find out more, head to timtopham.com/community.